the Yeshua and the Roman centurion, verses 1 through 10. Now when he had concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum, and a certain centurion's servant, who was dear to him, was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Yeshua, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Yeshua, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this thing was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. Then Yeshua went with them. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. Therefore I did not even think myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Yeshua heard these things, he marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. And those who were sent, returning to the house, found the servant well who had been sick. Here's the episode of the Roman centurion. The Lord Yeshua had just ended his sermon on the plain to his disciples, the parable of the two houses at the end of chapter 6. And we read in particular verse 1, he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people. When he taught his disciples, he did not exclude any and everyone who wished to be there, to listen in, to sit in on what he was saying to the others. This was in keeping with what Moses had told his people in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. The principle is, speak the word of God freely. Speak it freely to all who wish to listen. All who are within earshot. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 and 6, Moses says to his people, surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So Moses taught his people to, the same way as the Lord Yeshua did, publicly. It was not something that was to be whispered in the ear, but for all who wished to hear. A centurion, what is a centurion? It is a Roman officer over 100 men. That's why it's called centurion. That's the word from which we get century. He had a slave. That word servant really means slave. And what was exceptional about this centurion was he cared for his slave. In Roman culture, slaves were expendable. They were not worth anything. Their masters could do with them what they liked. And there were not a few who got so angry with their slaves, they crucified them, and nobody pointed a finger at them for doing this. But this man was different. He was his servant, his slave, dear to him, and at the point of death. He had heard about Yeshua, And the question arises, where and from whom had he heard from Yeshua? We can only guess. But remember, this centurion was in Capernaum. And there was also, around the same time, a nobleman who lived in Capernaum. We read about him in John chapter 4. Let's turn to John chapter 4. And perhaps, it was this nobleman who was, because he was a nobleman, he would be conversant with the Roman authorities, and he may have passed on his experience to this Roman centurion. In John chapter 4, verse 46. So Yeshua came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Yeshua had come out of Judea and into Galilee, he went to him and implored him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then Yeshua said to him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will by no means believe." The nobleman said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Yeshua said to him, "Go your way, your son lives." So the man believed the word that Yeshua spoke to him, and he went his way. And of course, he went back to Capernaum, but gladly to find that his son was well, and that he began to recover from the same hour that the Lord Yeshua had told him, "Your son lives." Now, being a nobleman, he'd be in Herod's court. And in Herod's court, there'd be also Roman authorities. Herod would have, of course, Herod was the friend of Caesar. And therefore, he would have Roman officers and Roman representatives and diplomats in his court. And this nobleman may have met the centurion in Capernaum, where they were both living, and had passed on the news. "Did you hear what Jesus of Nazareth did for my son?" It could have happened that way, that's how the centurion heard about Yeshua. And now he was in need. And he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. We're back in chapter 7, verse 3. But it looks from the narrative as though they garbled his request. He sent them asking for healing for his servant. They interpreted that to mean that he had to come and heal the servant. But from the language of the centurion that follows, it's clear the centurion didn't really want to disturb the Lord to that extent. We'll see that as we go. To heal means to save, to bring through safely, to heal his servant. So when they came to Yeshua, they begged him earnestly. That's in verse 4. They urgently pleaded with him. They said, the one for whom he should do this was deserving. They were stressing merit, because the Judaism of that day was very heavy on merit, salvation by merit, blessings by merit. And they, with their attitude, this kind of mentality, said, "This man has merited your interest, your attention." Saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving. And the reason was, verse 5, "For he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue." Well, there was only one in Capernaum. And that was probably then the one that the centurion had built. Those of you who have been to Israel know that it was quite a grand style synagogue. It had a gallery, it had upper floor as well as a lower floor. And From the ruins, we see that it was built with costly materials. Now, it could well be that this was the synagogue that the centurion had built. And they emphasize the fact, it's he who built us the synagogue. What was so exceptional? Well, the Romans didn't like the Hebrews. They didn't like the Jews. The Roman soldiers resented being in that dusty corner of the Roman Empire where there were always rebellions and insurrections and all kinds of disobedience to the Roman authorities. But here was someone that was different. He loved their people. He loves our nation. He is not like the others. He has built us the synagogue. Literally the definite article there. Now, the Lord Yeshua might have spent time debating with them. What do you mean he merits? Who merits anything? He could have picked a point with them on that issue. But the Lord in his graciousness always overlooks these slips of the tongue or these mistakes that people make. He sees the greater need. There's a slave that's dying. His master is in dire distress. What value is there having a theological debate on secondary issues in this situation? So ignoring the fact that they had done this, they had been mistaken in their theology, he went. Verse 6, then Yeshua went with them. He overlooked their error. But obviously his approach had been noticed by the centurion. And from the other accounts in the other Gospels, Mark and Matthew, we find that he noticed the Lord approaching and sent another deputation to meet him, to intercept him, to say, Lord, don't bother. Don't put yourself out to this extent. And when that didn't work, he came in person finally to try and plead with the Lord. Lord, I don't deserve this. They had said, the elders, he deserves this. The centurion said, I don't deserve this. And from the fact that he said, I don't deserve it, shows that he really didn't mean the Lord to put himself out to the extent of coming in person. I am not worthy. In that, he was like Jacob. Jacob, when he was in great need, he prayed with God in Genesis chapter 32. I am not worthy of the least of the mercies and of the truth that you have shown your servant. Here is the Roman centurion speaking in the language of homage and of humility. He says, Lord, there's the language of homage. I am not worthy. Here's the language of humility. And when he says, do not trouble yourself, that's in verse 6, he means stop troubling yourself. Cease from, desist, please desist from troubling yourself. This is too much of an honor for me. Why would he say, I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof? Well, we get a clue from the experience of Peter. In Acts chapter 10, we read of another centurion who sent for Peter. An angel had appeared to this Roman centurion and had warned him to go and fetch from Joppa a man called Simon, whose surname was Peter. And he will tell you what you need to hear. This centurion was a God-fearing centurion, just like this one was. Cornelius was the name of the other one. When Peter finally arrived at Cornelius's house, he said, you know that it is not lawful for a Jew to enter another person's, someone's house who's not a Jew. This is how he puts it in Acts chapter 10. And that gives us the clue. Acts 10, verse 28. Then he said to them, you know how unlawful it is for a Jewish man to keep company with or go to one of another nation, but God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Well, of course, this was not in the law of Moses. Nowhere in the law of Moses is it commanded that Jews were to keep separate from one of another nation. On the contrary, be hospitable to them, welcome them. If they wish to live in your land, make place for them, give them an inheritance among you. This is the language of the law. But what Peter was referring to was rabbinic law, not Mosaic law. It was man-made legislation. And it was unwarranted and unbiblical. But the centurion honored it, and therefore he says here, I am not worthy. I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. I do not wish to trample on Jewish sensitivities and Jewish sensibilities. I don't want to offend. We have at the moment a situation where some journalists have offended the devotees of a certain religion. Well, that's no way to win them. And although we may disagree with people of another faith, yet we are not to abuse their beliefs. So the centurion here says, verse 7, therefore, I did not even think myself worthy to come to you, but say the word, and my servant will be healed. He says, I don't need your personal presence. I am quite aware of your power. And perhaps that's another clue that it was the nobleman from Capernaum that told him about it, because that nobleman would have said to the centurion, my son was sick half a day's journey away, and yet the masters just spoke the word, and my son began to recover from that same hour. So the centurion said, he can do the same for me. He doesn't have to come. He didn't have to go all the way from Cana to Capernaum to heal the nobleman's son. He can speak the word, and my slave will be healed in the same way as the nobleman's son was healed. But there's another reason why he says that. He says in verse 8, for I also am a man placed under authority. And what he's really saying there is, I recognize that you are under authority, that you have been given authority from one above you. Just as I have been given authority by Caesar. And because of my authority given to me by Caesar, I can say to one, go, do this, and he has to go and he has to do this. And I know that you have the same authority in your sphere of responsibility. And you can do what I do, only in a higher level. See, that's what the Roman centurion was really saying here. He recognized delegated authority. The word I is emphatic. I myself also am a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. You have authority over sickness, over evil spirits, over other spiritual matters here. So just say, just speak the word, and I know my slave will recover. The word used for slave here, my servant, verse 7, say the word and my servant will be healed, is a tender word, which means my houseboy. It shows how much he esteemed this slave of his. So analogously, you can speak the word of command and it will happen. I have no doubt about the matter. That's what the centurion meant. And then we read in verse 9, when Yeshua heard these things, he marveled at him. Oh, say the critics, if he was all-knowing, how could he marvel? Well, let me appeal to your own experience and mine. How many times have you read the story of Joseph? How many times have you read the story of Elisha and the woman from Shunem, whose little son had died? We know the story, but every time we read it, it grips us again. It moves us again. So that when Yeshua marveled, it's not because he didn't know, but just as the repeat experience of coming into contact with a situation moves us again, whatever it might be in our experience. So the Lord marveled at him. He was truly man, and therefore he was capable of joy, of sorrow, of admiration. And in this case, he marveled at him. He admired this man's faith. He knew it was there, but just as you and I over and again find this same experience, so he too. He marveled at him and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, now it's a reproof to his own people, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. In keeping with his omniscience, with his all-knowingness, he marvels. God marvels. You'd think that God would be exempt from marveling, but no. Isaiah the prophet tells us in chapter 59 that God also marvels at certain situations. He knows the end from the beginning, but still that emotion is attributed to him. Isaiah chapter 59, let me read verse 15 and 16. So truth fails, and he who departs from evil makes himself a prey. Then the Lord saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. He saw that there was no man, and wondered that there was no intercessor. Therefore his own arm brought salvation for him, and his own righteousness, it sustained him. Yeshua is our God-man, our Emmanuel. He is God made man. And just as God marvels in the prophet Isaiah, we read he wondered, so Yeshua here marveled at the centurion's faith. And those who were sent, returning to the house, found the servant well who had been sick. Alas, where it should have been found, it was not found. That faith was sadly lacking. The people of Israel had, as one writer put it recently, they had received their syllabus in order. They had been taught the word of God from A to Z, from Genesis to 2 Chronicles, because that's how the Hebrew Bible is arranged. Genesis, the first book, 2 Chronicles is the last in the Hebrew Bible. They had learned it all in due order. And yet, when Messiah came in due order, they did not have as much faith as this Roman centurion had. So Messiah stopped. He didn't go. He didn't go any further. We don't even read that he pronounced the word of healing. We don't have a record of it, as far as I know. But when the centurion returned home, after intercepting the master, he found the slave well and whole. Messiah was turned back. The request was granted. In Mark chapter 7 and verse 29, it's a record of the same event. Not the same event, a similar event. A woman who came to ask for her daughter. Mark 7, verse 29. Then he said to her, for this saying, go your way. The demon has gone out of your daughter. Because of her faith and because of his faith. We see these outstanding examples of Gentiles who believed in the God of Israel, who trusted him more than God's own people. What a tragedy. What can we learn from this? True devotion is richly rewarded. Great faith does not depend on outward things, but great faith pictures its, at least focuses on the person of Messiah. That's what this woman did, whose daughter was demon-possessed in Mark chapter 7. That's what this centurion did. Lord, he calls him. I am not worthy. See his how duly estimates the greatness of Messiah's person. So great faith concentrates, focuses on him. From verse 11 to verse 17, we have another moving episode, the widow's son. How many times you and I have read it and how it moves us. What tenderness, what compassion come out. How we empathize with that poor woman, having lost her husband and now the only crumb of comfort taken away from her when her only son dies. How we empathize with her. We feel sympathy for her. Well, let's look at it. From verse 11 to 17. Now it happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her, and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. Then fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen up among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region. The day after, that means afterwards, he went into a city called Nain. It would be a town close to Nazareth, where Messiah had been brought up. It was a day's journey from Capernaum. So we are looking at our Lord's Galilean ministry. He walked to many places. He traveled great distances on foot, and many of his disciples with him, and a large crowd. He had his followers, and he had those that were just coming out of curiosity or who were impressed, but not to the point that they were his disciples. But he didn't say to them, "You cannot come with me." He welcomed all who wished to follow him. The disciples would be the 12 that he chose. And there would be others too. Mentioned in chapter 8, there were godly women who also followed him around. Uncommitted followers, committed followers. And one thing we read about it, they were a large crowd. This large crowd following Messiah anticipated or met with another large crowd. Verse 12, and when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. Two large crowds meeting one another. He came near the gate of the city. Graves were usually outside the city, and that's why this dead man was being carried out. Graves had uncleanness about them. in the law of Moses, anyone who touched a grave or a tomb was ritually unclean. And they had to go through a cleansing ceremony, which included being sprinkled with the ashes of a red heifer mixed with water. People could not keep the Passover if they touched a tomb, unless they could get cleansing in time. They had to be sprinkled on the third day and on the seventh day. So people would make sure the graves were not close to where they lived. The graves and tombs were always outside the city. A young man, it was a young man, because that's what Messiah says in verse 14, young man, I say to you, arise. He was young, in his prime, and his mother was following the bier, the coffin, the open coffin. Usually what happened in funeral ceremonies was they carried the dead person, and behind the dead person came the mourners. When David's general, at least David's would-be general, was murdered, Abner was murdered, David, we read, followed the bier. The funeral procession was led by those carrying the dead person on a stretcher or in an open coffin. Then the mourners came behind. And if anyone wished to say something, they would say it either during the funeral procession or at the grave. In the case of David, David spoke a eulogy. Died Abner as a fool dieth. That was at the grave where they were going to commit Abner's dead body. In this case, they had not got that far. They had not got to the grave as well. Here was this woman, broken-hearted. And with her, there would be those friends and neighbors who would also be weeping and mourning, not only out of sympathy with her, but there were also mourners who were very skillful at mourning, taking up a weeping and a wailing so that tears would run down. Jeremiah the prophet mentions, send for the cunning women that they may come and lift up a mourning for us that our eyes may gush out with tears. They helped the mourning process. So there were those who were genuinely mourning and those who were only there to help it on. When the Lord saw her, we read in verse 13, and the word Lord here seems to be emphasized in the text. When the Lord saw her, he in his capacity as Lord, in other words, he had compassion on her. And every time we read about the Lord having compassion, it is always with a view to act. He's going to do something. When God looked upon his people in the land of Egypt, he had compassion on them for their groaning in their slavery. It was the cause of many miracles. We read before many miracles the Lord had done. It was because of his compassion. He was moved. And there again we see he knew all about it. When he came to raise up Lazarus from the dead, he knew he was going to raise Lazarus, but he still wept. Messiah's humanity was perfect as well as his deity. He was altogether human as well as altogether divine. He was a partaker of the same emotions that you and I suffer under or enjoy. He had compassion on her and said to her, do not weep. She didn't know who he was. Who was this stranger who was telling her to do the impossible? And why should she not weep? Those thoughts may have gone through her mind. But the reason why he said to her, do not weep, is because there was no longer any need to weep. When God met Abraham's maidservant in her wanderings after Abraham had put her out of the house, he said, what is the matter with you, Hagar? In other words, there's no problem. Your problem is not a real one. Or your problem is ended here. And as it was, when she heard those words, she arose and she looked around, and there was a well with the precious water that she needed for herself and for her son to survive. So it is here the Messiah comes. And remember, the one who told Hagar, "What aileth thee, Hagar?" is the same one that's here saying to the widow, "Do not weep." Because the one that spoke to Hagar was the angel of the Lord. It was Messiah before he came to earth. This great mystery. Verse 14. Then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. Well, of course, he touched the coffin. He's going to say something. They didn't realize what he was going to say. They thought he was going to say what a fine young man he was, and I'm sure that all is well with his soul. Nothing of the sort. He said something that they didn't expect. "Young man, I say to you, arise." Why does he say, "I say to you"? In that sense, "I say to you, arise." That's the emphasis there. To you, I say, arise. To your mother, I say, do not weep. And the reason is because to you, I say, arise. And there's the reason why she should not weep. That's the sense here, too. His omnipotent command. Someone said when the Lord called out at Lazarus' tomb, "Lazarus, come forth," he had to mention who it was that was to come forth. That may well be true. And what do we read happened? Verse 15. So he who was dead sat up and began to speak, proof of life. And he presented him to his mother. Now she knew why he said to her, "Do not weep." He delivered him. Presented him is a good word, because the sense is he made a present of him to his mother. There's the compassion and the grace of Messiah, making a present to that woman of the one she valued most. He put back in her hands that precious treasure that she had lost. And we read about God with Job. God gave to Job twice as many as he had before, out of his compassion, out of his mercy. Then fear came upon all, and they glorified God. There are two things they said. A great prophet has risen up among us. God has visited his people. Those are the two sayings that they spread abroad concerning Messiah. The term "visited" is the word used of physicians paying a house call. God has visited the great physician in the person of his son, is making a house call to his people who are sick of sin. He has come to heal them, to cure them, to raise the spiritually dead. And in token of that, he raises the physically dead. So this saying we read, this report about him went throughout all Judea and all the surrounding region. In these two accounts of Messiah's ministry, we see his grace, his compassion, his loving heart. How true it is that hymn that says he sympathizes with our grief and to the sufferer sends relief. He was tempted like in all points like as we are, yet without sin. He knows what it is to be tested with the same. He is able to succor them, to make propitiation for the sins of his people. In all things he had to be made like his brethren. That's in Hebrews 2 verse 17. That he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. In Hebrews 4 we read, "We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. I close with an exhortation. Here it is in Hebrews 4, verse 16. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. What is your need? To whom may you go? You may go to the throne of grace. We can come to him because the Bible says we will obtain mercy and we will find grace to help in time of need. May the Lord bless his word this morning.